Thank you, and welcome to today's media-only teleconference to examine municipal financial distress. Declining housing values, restrictive credit markets, slowed consumer spending, and rising unemployment are leading some cities and municipalities to consider the option of filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. In contrast to consumer or business bankruptcies, Chapter 9 does not contain a provision in the law for liquidation of the assets of the municipality and distribution of the proceeds to creditors. Additionally, the 10th Amendment limitation on federal powers means that in a Chapter 9 case, the bankruptcy court has very little involvement with the operation of a municipality. Joining us today is a panel of experts to explain the causes of a municipal bankruptcy filing, its effects on the actual municipality, and their thoughts on whether a potential wave of Chapter 9 filings is likely in the near future. The program will consist of about 30 minutes of opening commentary by our experts, and then we will take your questions. Our speakers include Bruce Bennett, who is a founding partner of Hennigan, Bennett, and Dorman, and heads its business reorganization and bankruptcy department. Bennett was the lead debtors counsel in the country's largest Chapter 9 bankruptcy, Orange County, California, which filed for Chapter 9 in the mid-90s following a $1.7 billion loss in the county's investment pools. Lisa Hill Fenning is a partner in the bankruptcy and corporate reorganization practice at Arnold & Porter. From 1985 to 2000, Fenning served as a U.S. bankruptcy judge for the Central District of California. Mark Levinson is a partner in the restructuring group of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. He is the lead attorney in the Chapter 9 filing of the City of Vallejo, California. Our moderator for the program will be Georgetown University Law Professor Adam Levitin, ABI's resident scholar. I'll now turn it over to our moderator for the program, Professor Adam Levitin.
Good afternoon. So I think the way we should start by thinking about this is trying to answer the question of what causes Chapter 9? Why do municipalities file for bankruptcy? What precipitates a filing? Bruce, do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. And you know, this goes back to one of the themes that John mentioned at the beginning, which is, you know, do we expect a lot of filings? And I'll come back to that in a second. Municipal debtors file Chapter 9 cases when they run out of money, and I mean run out of cash. The only relevant statistic generally when a municipality is looking at this is that they actually have gotten to the end of their ability to pay the next debt that's becoming due. And there are all kinds of reasons for that that we can go into. Mostly it has to do with the fact that there is no other usually covenants or restrictions that kick in that require a municipality to confront a value imbalance or a budget imbalance or another kind of problem that would ordinarily cause a commercial business to seek bankruptcy relief or seek to restructure its financial affairs. The only kind of problem that pushes municipalities to confront deeper financial problems is an actual liquidity crisis. And when you go to history and look at the cases that have been filed historically, including even Orange County, the largest, you will find that somewhere in there was a major financial shock that was so severe that it actually threatened the relevant municipality's ability to pay current bills on a current basis. And there are, of course, exceptions. No sweeping generalizations are ever going to work completely in this field. But I think that, as a general principle, that is where the trigger is.
So, Mark, do you have any thoughts on this? What causes municipal bankruptcy filings?
Even though I reserve the right to disagree with Bruce later, I do not disagree with anything that he said. Let me take it down to the specific level of Vallejo and what happened in Vallejo. As Bruce predicted, Vallejo filed because it ran out of cash. California law prohibits a municipality from running an imbalanced general fund budget. The way things work in California is because cash flow, particularly for cities, is periodic. Cities don't make an even amount of dollars each month. They get their property tax payments four times a year. They get sales tax payments periodically. The city's general fund at times doesn't have cash to pay the general fund obligations, such as payroll. So what general funds do is they borrow from specific restricted funds and then pay them back at the end of the year, which is perfectly legitimate. But if the city lacks the ability to pay back the restricted fund within a year, within the fiscal year, it simply can't write checks without violating California law, which I will tell you many cities are doing, but Vallejo refused to do based on our advice that the officers would be violating the law. So Vallejo had no choice but to file a bankruptcy case because, as the bankruptcy judge found after a long hearing, Vallejo simply lacked the ability, as Bruce said, to make the first payroll of fiscal 08-09, and therefore without borrowing from restricted funds, which it couldn't do. The bankruptcy code contains a number of restrictions that limit the eligibility for bankruptcy, and we can get into this later if there's time, but because federal law ought not to be used often to interfere with the operations of states, and that's what the 10th Amendment is all about, the federal law limits eligibility for bankruptcy, and one of the key requirements is that the city be insolvent. And insolvency in the bankruptcy code is defined as to municipalities to mean you're out of cash. Either you can't pay your bills right now or you cannot pay your bills in the near future. In a City of Bridgeport, Connecticut case 15, 20 years ago, the court found that the City of Bridgeport had enough money to pay its bills for the current fiscal year and in fact would wind up with, an $11 million overage after the fiscal year and kicked the city out of bankruptcy, because it wasn't an immediate cash crunch. In Vallejo, it was an immediate cash crunch. As Bruce said, you're looking at cash not only because of this requirement, but because you can't liquidate a city. You can't go out and, certainly under California law, force a city to sell City Hall or to sell a park, to sell excess real estate. That's prohibited under California law. So that's why you're looking at cash. Other eligibility requirements include the city's effort prior to bankruptcy to negotiate a plan with its creditors to avoid bankruptcy, and of course, to have a resolution passed by the governing body of the municipality, either the city council or the county board of supervisors or the hospital district, whichever you're talking about, authorizing the bankruptcy. And finally, and perhaps equally importantly, is the state has to authorize its municipalities to file bankruptcy. So if a state law is silent on the subject, and many state laws are, the only way that a municipality can file for bankruptcy in that state is to go to the legislature and to get approval by the legislature of the bankruptcy filing. California law, as we sit now, has a very broad, expansive permission to municipalities to file bankruptcy. It essentially says if you're a municipality, you may file a bankruptcy case. There's efforts underway in California to change that, led by the Firefighters Union, and the bill made it through the Assembly this year, but it did not make it through the State Senate, and almost assuredly will be brought again next year by the firefighters in order to prohibit cities from filing bankruptcy cases. The ramifications of that could be severe. I will say it will not affect Vallejo because it's not retroactive.
Well, there's some major distinctions between municipal bankruptcies and pretty much every other type of bankruptcy, that for corporate bankruptcies or consumer bankruptcies, you don't have to be insolvent to file for bankruptcy. There's no solvency test for filing. And similarly, you don't need to have state law affirmatively permitting you to file. Those are some very interesting contrasts there. Lisa, well, what are some other of the issues that can lead to a bankruptcy filing for a municipality?
In the long run, a lot of municipalities are facing the sort of problem that led to all the talk about a possible bankruptcy filing for San Diego. They have promised very generous retirement benefits for their employees, and those legacy obligations are piling up to the point where, for many cities, the retirement obligations exceed their current payroll by a factor of many times. The general structure of public employment in a state like California has been an interesting kind of a compact over the years. In principle, the generous retirement benefits are supposed to be a reward for long-term service and to compensate for lower salaries compared with the private sector. But at the same time that those generous packages have been negotiated, there's been pressure for the current salaries to come closer to market levels. And so overall, there's been this upward pressure on both current salaries and retirement packages. Many municipalities and the state allow for early retirement after 20, 25 years under various formulas. So some of the retirees are actually quite young and are going into the workforce for other jobs, and at the same time they're drawing the retirement benefits. This overhang of these legacy obligations, including medical packages of various types, are the same kind of legacy problems that led to the bankruptcy filings of the steel companies, the airlines, and many other traditionally unionized types of businesses in order to get the load of the retirement benefits taken off their shoulders or modified in some way, either given back to the PBGC or otherwise relieve it. The problem for municipal filings, though, if you look at what I've just described, those are long-term problems. You can look at a city like San Diego and say, how in the world are they ever going to be able to pay all of their legacy obligations in 10 years? But they're not out of cash today. If they're not out of cash today, they will have a problem meeting the standard for immediate insolvency, even if they know that they can't possibly, in any scenario that they can quite come up with, meet all their long-term obligations down the road. This legacy problem is building, and it's the overhang for many of these cities and other municipal units, as well as for the state employees. And there's no clear answer to it, because bankruptcy will have quite a bit of difficulty trying to solve that sort of problem. But that was behind the San Diego talk a couple years ago. San Diego did not file. They've been trying to work out their legacy obligations. But it's still that problem is still there, very live for them and for many, if not all, of the municipalities in California, at least.
So when a municipality files for Chapter 9, what happens? What are the effects of filing for Chapter 9? Bruce, do you want to address that?
Well, I think here again there's a pattern that we should start by saying there's two kinds of, at least in my mind, and the other panelists may disagree, there are kind of two major categories of municipalities that seek relief under Chapter 9. One is a general purpose municipality, Vallejo, County of Orange, Bridgeport. They're a city. They provide all kinds of services to residents. And then the other kind is a special purpose municipality. What ought to be the most famous one in California, I'm not sure it is Ventura Port District, for example. Ventura Port District not only didn't have a geographic boundary on real property, it didn't own real property, it actually leased its only site. But there are special purpose municipalities kind of all over the place, and they're a different class of case, and I don't think people are interested in those for this purpose of this call, but if they are, they should ask about them. But a general purpose municipality case kind of goes pursuant to a pattern that I think has been established in many, which is right after there's a filing, there is the suggestion by creditors that the municipality ought to be able to cut costs and sell surplus assets. And the truth is that, frankly, most municipalities that get in trouble have already cut costs very significantly. And after close examination, people usually find that you're not going to be able to cut costs very much more, although maybe you can a little bit on the edges. And you can't sell very many properties. There isn't much in the way of surplus properties, and the properties that are the really good properties are probably places that are needed to maintain essential functions, like it's where the city hall is, or something like that. And so even if there are some assets to be sold or some expenses to be cut, the truth turns out to be, almost always, that the effect is modest and the impact on repaying creditors is almost too hard to measure. So the focus is always, or seemingly always, turns to revenue raising. And here you have another bifurcation, which is on the one side is California, and it also turns out Hawaii, although nobody talks about that very much, and almost the rest of the United States. And in California and Hawaii, municipalities do not have unlimited taxing power. For the most part, and there are important exceptions, in the rest of the country, municipalities have unlimited taxing power. So the next issue becomes, can taxes be raised within the within the taxing power of the relevant municipality, Congress, and California being different than the rest? And then the question is, how much should taxes be raised? And that becomes a very important source of the debate. I will end by just saying that historically, courts have gotten involved in this in deciding how much taxes have to be raised prior to the court confirming a plan that pays debt less than in full. They don't do it directly. The court doesn't have the power to raise taxes, but the court has the power to approve a plan as being in the best interest of creditors or not. And when considering whether a plan is in the best interest of creditors, the court decides whether the municipality has exerted vigorous enough efforts, extensive enough efforts to raise money. And the standard that's most frequently discussed is a standard called death spiral, which is if a municipality is going to, by raising taxes, is going to damage its condition and the atmosphere for its residents so much that the town or county is going to atrophy, the people are going to leave, then you don't have to raise taxes that much. And there haven't been a lot of cases that have applied this in the past, but there are a lot, I mean, more than a handful. And one has to wonder whether if we have a recession for a few more years, and if more municipalities get further and further stressed, and the amount of the taxes have to be raised becomes material, whether we are going to see courts more involved in the question of how high do taxes have to be raised by municipalities to pay debts if they get into trouble.
Mark, do you have any thoughts on this?
Let me talk a little bit first about the contract aspect of bankruptcy, the other side of bankruptcy. When a company is in Chapter 11, you have a couple of ways to fix it, and the two easiest are either you raise revenue or you cut costs, and invariably you try to do both. In a city or municipality, as for the reasons that Bruce gave, raising revenue is difficult, particularly in this political environment, and particularly in California, where just about everything of import has to go to the voters. The city council can raise fees, but those are peanuts compared to the real dollars that need to be raised that can only be raised by sales tax or statewide by property taxes somehow. So it's hard to fill that side of the equation other than through, as Bruce said, this death spiral. We'll talk later about the political realities, but I'll give you a hint that the political realities are it's impossible to do, and it will be impossible in Vallejo. What did Vallejo do on the cutting revenue side, on cutting expense side? Well, prior to filing the bankruptcy case, it exhausted all of its general fund cushion. It had a residual of millions of dollars, as all cities do, carrying over from years to year. But it lost all of that by spending it down rather than filing a bankruptcy case and rather than breaching contracts. But with no reserves left entering the fiscal year, that's why we got into the kind of trouble that I talked about earlier. Vallejo also cut back on community-based organization funding. The library is barely open. The symphony is no longer funded. The city-run museum is closed. The streets aren't repaired the way they should be. Police cars aren't replaced every 2 years as they should be unless the city gets federal grants for it. The police, and by the way, Vallejo has a terrific police force. It's a tough town. It's got a great police force. The police are forced to ride around in 3-, 4-, 5-year-old vehicles that should have been replaced. And they're repaired, but it isn't the same. There was really nowhere else to go. But because of the insolvency requirement and because of the immediacy, as opposed to what Lisa talked about with the legacy costs that kick in later, You had to cut everything you could possibly cut. And cities have done that. Vallejo's not the only one. And if you in the media know that all cities around the country, and certainly in California, are cutting back on everything. The headlines every day are police agree to concessions, road services cut, employees laid off, and the like. In Vallejo, the largest cost to the general fund was labor, and specifically the safety workers, namely fire and police. Their contracts were overly generous. The press has reported about that quite a bit. I won't go into it. But they were paid incredibly well. As Lisa said, they could retire early with full health benefits or near health, full health benefits with generous pensions that they had accumulated over the years. That was the deal under the collective bargaining agreements, but the city simply couldn't live under the collective bargaining agreements. And so what we did in the bankruptcy case is we fought with the unions, and ultimately two of the collective bargaining agreements were rejected. And with the two other unions, police and the middle managers, we were able to cut deals on new longer-term contracts the city could better afford than the older-term contracts, the workers making significant concessions. We were unable to do so with fire and with the miscellaneous employees who were represented by IBEW, and we are in the process now of attempting to negotiate new agreements with them, but their old ones are off the table, and we're paying at a rate that the city can afford to pay. A drastic, painful, expensive remedy, but nonetheless one that was required in order for the city to survive.
So, Lisa, what about the effects on social services?
I had an interesting perspective on municipal bankruptcies as a citizen of Orange County who experienced the direct impact of the Orange County bankruptcy filing. So let me talk about that for just a moment, and then I'll circle back to some special issues on who actually gets assigned cases and how that part works for Chapter 9, because that was an interesting story in Orange County. But the day that the case filed, as you may be aware, not only were funds tied up for the county itself, but many school districts and other special municipal units had common investment funds with the county, and therefore their funds were affected as well by the collapse of the investments that Orange County had undertaken. And therefore, day one, the schools announced, and I had four kids in the public school system, they announced that they did not have enough money to buy photocopy, paper, ink, any supplies for the schools. They were just cutting everything off completely. And in very short order, the schools started running out of supplies. The school districts just didn't know what to expect, so they cut everything off. And we ended up, at least in our area, the parents would bring in boxes of copying paper and other supplies to help restock the school and keep the school functioning at that very basic level, because there was literally no money for anything whatsoever for a while. After a while, it normalized, but the cuts in public services were obvious and immediate and ongoing. So the impact on the population is pretty stark and immediate. But let me talk about how that case got assigned. I was a bankruptcy judge at the time sitting in Los Angeles, even though I lived in Orange County. The cases are not put on the wheel for random assignment like other Chapter 11 or 7 or 13 cases. Chapter 9 municipality cases are especially assigned at the direction of the appellate courts. And this one ended up being assigned to John Ryan, one of my colleagues in the district. But interestingly, although he sat in Santa Ana, we have one of our divisional courthouses in Santa Ana in the center of Orange County, he actually lived in Escondido in San Diego County, so that he actually was not directly affected by the case. There was a concern that any of the bankruptcy judges who lived in Orange County, and there were about five or six of us in the district, would be conflicted as citizens if we actually sat on the case. And so there will be some interesting issues if there are large bankruptcy cases, trying to make sure that the bankruptcy judge who's assigned is both nearby and immediate because the local interest is extremely high and the court should be accessible, but on the other hand, not directly affected by the impacts on the citizens of the municipality.
Well, this is Mark. Let me just add that the chief judge of the circuit who assigns the judge isn't limited to picking one from the locality. So when I talked to Vallejo about filing a Chapter 9 case, I said I assumed it would be probably one of two judges in Sacramento, which is the proper venue, because we have two very experienced, very smart, very good judges here, and two who are good but are less experienced. But I said it also could be a judge from Judge Ryan come out of retirement from Orange County, or could be some judge from Montana or something, because as Lisa said, you want somebody who's just free of any local influence. Because Vallejo is about 50 miles and 50 minutes away from Sacramento, and Judge McManus, who was selected, does not live anywhere near Vallejo, he was a good and logical choice. But again, due to the nature of Chapter 9, the chief judge of the circuit has the ability to pick pretty much anyone throughout the circuit.
When you end up in, when a city ends up in Chapter 9, how does it finance itself? The financing is usually a major problem for corporate reorganizations, that you need to, that the company needs to find some source of liquidity for, so it can keep paying its bills as they come due during the bankruptcy, as well as, you know, paying the costs of the bankruptcy. How do cities deal with that?
Well, this is Bruce. The provisions permitting debtor in possession financing are actually applicable to Chapter 9. They're not often necessary because Chapter 9 does have the automatic stay component and protects the municipality from the consequences of failing to pay debts. So the way most municipalities finance themselves through their cases is they don't pay historical debts, and they use all their cash flow to provide current services, and that has normally been enough. In Orange County, to alleviate a problem school districts were having, we did do a debtor in possession financing during the Orange County bankruptcy case. It was big for its time. It was somewhere between $400 or $500 million. These days, people wouldn't regard that as big anymore. And so the path has been plowed. There's precedent. Pretty clearly can be done, but it's unlikely to be necessary in a general purpose municipality, absent a really severe situation.
Who was the lender in Orange County for the debtor in possession facility?
It was actually sold to the public, believe it or not. It was a publicly issued facility, was bought mostly by mutual funds focusing on tax-free investments. It was a very well-protected piece of paper, had some special legislation that gave it a security interest in a very stable source of tax revenue.
Now, what happens, in most municipalities, a lot of the workers are unionized. How does the municipal bankruptcy affect their contracts?
Well, as the lawyers on the phone call know, that there's a special provision for rejection of collective bargaining agreements that applies only in Chapter 11 cases. That provision does not apply in bankruptcy in Chapter 9 cases. Congress, for whatever reason, chose not to do that. So the bankruptcy court, after hearing and controversy and our fighting with the unions, ruled back in March that collective bargaining agreements, which the Supreme Court has said are simply contracts, a specialized form of contract, would be rejected or assumed pursuant to Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code, which deals with other contracts, leases, supply agreements, and the like. And we, in fact, filed a motion early in the case to reject the four collective bargaining agreements that were extant at the time. As I said earlier, we ultimately settled with two of the unions, but we took the other two all the way through battles before Judge McManus on whether the city satisfied the requirements that the Supreme Court set out in a Chapter 11 case before Congress amended the law to make a specialized section for rejection of collective bargaining agreements in Chapter 11. And the test essentially was are the contracts burdensome on the city, which they clearly were. The city couldn't afford to pay them. Did the city do its best to avoid rejecting the collective bargaining agreement, and would it be impracticable to actually reach an agreement during the course of the case? And when you balance the hardships between the rejection on the union and non-rejection on the city, did the balance tilt in favor of the city? The judge found in the city's favor on all three points, as he was required to do if we were to satisfy the test. But before he found on the point about would a contract be possibly negotiated, a new one, he required the parties to enter mediation. And a bankruptcy judge from Portland, Oregon, Elizabeth Paris, was assigned to oversee the mediation, and Judge Paris did a phenomenal job and gave many, many, many hours in meetings and phone calls and emails and the like. And as a result of her good efforts, we reached agreement with the firefighters that their contract would be rejected. But in return for that, we agreed to an expedited process to try to reach a new agreement. But the city still declared that a huge victory. We could not reach agreement with the final union, and we told the judge, and ultimately he ruled in our favor. But it was a painful, expensive process, but in the end, the city was successful in rejecting these contracts.
Chapter 9 certainly has some unique complications, that there isn't a particularly robust statutory framework for it, that relative to the other chapters of the Bankruptcy Code, Chapter 9 is a pretty thin one. How does that affect things, Lisa?
It creates gaps and pitfalls. The structure of Chapter 9 is that it only incorporates those provisions of the Bankruptcy Code that are specifically incorporated into Chapter 9. In other words, instead of the pattern of Chapter 7 or Chapter 11, where most of the provisions for avoidance actions, administration of the case, and so forth are automatically incorporated, in Chapter 9, it's a pick and choose kind of odd process. And that has to do with the issues we've discussed already, namely the limitations of federal interference in the operations of local governments, and in the case of the collective bargaining agreement issue, just a decision not to incorporate that provision for whatever reason Congress chose not to incorporate it. So in trying to deal with Chapter 9 cases, it's imperative to just walk through the very specific incorporation or non-incorporation provisions of the code. That produces some anomalous results. Things happen in Chapter 9 cases that cannot happen in any other kind of cases, like the situation in Vallejo with the ruling that the test in Section 1113 of the Bankruptcy Code that's supposed to require very stringent steps to be taken before any possible rejection of a collective bargaining agreement can take place, that those just don't apply. That kind of ruling applies only in Chapter 9 cases. Other rulings around the country in Chapter 11 cases on what you have to do to reject the collective bargaining agreement are irrelevant in Chapter 9 ultimately, although they look at those for guidance. There are very few Chapter 9 cases that have ended up with litigated, published decisions on these issues about gaps and oddities, like most large bankruptcy cases. Most of the issues end up in settlement because it's too scary to take the risk of going to litigation, and litigation takes too long. The appellate system in the bankruptcy process is a major deterrent to trying to litigate to ultimate conclusion with most issues, because you have to first go the bankruptcy appellate panel or district court as an intermediate court of appeals before you reach the circuit court of appeals. And that process can take years to get all the way to a final judgment and a denial of cert, even at the circuit level. And so, like most cases, the matters get settled. There may be an early ruling on one aspect of the legal issues, but most legal issues end up not being in a reported decision. And there are so few Chapter 9 cases out there anyway, you end up with almost no case law on the special issues of Chapter 9, and you end up having to borrow from other chapters, even though it's not necessarily directly applicable.
All right. What are the limits of what of how you can readjust debts in Chapter 9? Anyone want to take that one?
Bruce will start. There are two principal limits. One is a basic bankruptcy principle that applies everywhere else in the code, and that is that for most purposes, there are exceptions here too, similarly situated creditors have to be treated the same way. So for example, although Mark will talk more about this, I'm sure if he wants to, in Vallejo, the labor unions feel like they're being singled out, and other creditors might hope that the labor unions are singled out, but the truth is that they can't be, that if there is a adjustment made to the amount of benefits and pensions or other payments owed to labor, and let's say after you figure it all out, they're getting 20 cents on the dollar or 30 cents on the dollar, whatever number it's going to be, then if there's other commercial creditors that also have the same kinds of claims, unsecured claims, they're getting 30 cents on the dollar too. So equality of treatment, it remains a principle in Chapter 9 just as it's a principle in all of the rest of the code. And again, there are some differences, but so it's another generalization that has to be somewhat qualified. The second major principle is that the plan that is confirmed has to meet the best interest test. It's hard to really give that a lot of content in general. I did mention one aspect of it before, and one aspect is that in order for a plan to be in best interests of creditors, the relevant municipality doesn't have to tax its citizens to the point where everyone picks up and moves. The same would apply to increases in fees. Short digression here. Everyone on the phone has probably heard something about the Jefferson County case and about the sewer district there. It's actually not a separate municipality. It's part of the county. And there are bonds there that are called special revenue bonds, so that also implicates some more law that we're not going to talk about today. But one of the issues is should they have to raise more revenue? I haven't done this work personally, but reliable people who I regard as reliable have done the work and have determined that the sewer fees in Jefferson County are the highest in the state where it's located and probably the second highest nationally. And so one has to, if that's true, one has to question whether a bankruptcy judge is really going to order that fees be raised still further than that. One issue that implicates best interest of creditors is, has the municipality done enough to raise money to pay creditors through taxing, through cutting expenses, through selling surplus assets, all those things that we talked about earlier? It's not a liquidation-based test because it's very clear that a municipality does not have to sell its city hall, does not have to sell all of its parks, does not have to sell its garbage collection sites, does not have to sell its utility poles. I mean, the list of things that municipalities are going to be allowed to keep is very long. Beyond that, there's not a lot of content. This is another part of the statute where courts are given leeway, and I would argue also that skilled practitioners are given room for creativity in order to fashion something that works and that they can convince a judge is reasonable under the circumstances.
So creditors' main protection then in Chapter 9 is that the plan be in their best interest. They don't have a vote, though, correct?
No, they do get to vote. And
they do. I was not aware of that.
No,
okay.
They definitely get to vote, and acceptance is important because if it's accepted, the best interest test doesn't even apply or won't be applied very rigorously to those classes.
I've never dealt with a Chapter 9 bankruptcy myself. These are rather rarities, so I've never, until this call actually, this is the first time I started looking through Chapter 9, the provisions of Chapter 9, and I must have missed the the plan vote provision. I was looking through it saying, wow, that's quite different than everything else, but apparently it's not.
Well,
so
yeah, this is Mark. It's different and it's not, and I just will weigh in by my silence to say that in Vallejo we're in the process of formulating a plan, so I really can't chime in on this part because I'm in the middle of it. But Bruce certainly has it right about you do need a vote and there are certain protections and you can't discriminate against certain creditors. Much of the confirmation standards of Chapter 11 are incorporated, but not all. So when you're doing a plan, you have to go back and forth between 1129 and Chapter 9 and see what's been incorporated and what hasn't been. And then there are special confirmation standards in Chapter 9 itself.
Okay, so there's an incorporation of a lot of Chapter 11 into Chapter 9. But Chapter 9 has some political issues in it that are not going to appear in a Chapter 11. Would you like to talk about those, Bruce or Mark?
Again, it's easier for me to talk about them as I'm not in a pending case, so at least I'll start. Most municipalities are run by elected officials, and I don't have to tell anyone on the phone that if there's one thing about that people know about their elected officials, and open paren, that's when they know something about their elected officials. Most people don't. It's what their position is on the last vote to raise taxes. And the political pressures not to raise taxes, even when a municipality is in a state of extreme financial difficulty, are immense. There's this interesting interplay between a court that doesn't have the power to raise taxes, but a court that has the power to confirm a plan that might be exercised only if taxes are raised or there's an effort made to raise taxes. You have a judge who expects a sincere effort to raise taxes, and what I mean by that is that in some municipalities, in bankruptcy cases, a tax increase has been put on the ballot, and then key elected officials have campaigned against it. That did not, by the way, happen in Orange County. A tax was put on the ballot. There was a major business community support for passing it, even though everyone expected it would be extremely difficult to pass. The politicians, some supported it, some at least stayed silent. No one in responsible positions were against it. It failed anyway. So the reality that raising taxes is extremely difficult still applies even when the counties or municipalities are in trouble. It still applies even when there are threats to social services, and remains a very heavy challenge. The other point that's also true is that if you look over time and carefully go back through the records, most of the time, whether or not they created the problem, the elected officials who are at the relevant municipality when there's a filing, whether or not they were there when the problem was first created, very frequently wind up booted out of office. And that's another reality, that they're all fighting for their jobs while at the municipality is fighting for its life. And that has an impact, too. You can't ignore it. It's real.
This is Mark. I'll just add. Oh, Lisa, I've been talking a lot. Why don't you go?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the dynamic of the process. Bruce is absolutely right. The pressure against raising taxes is immense, and the public officials lose their jobs. But the interesting part of either Chapter 11 or Chapter 9 is that it's, in a sense, a structured form of mediation, where the idea is that everyone is trying to work toward a consensual plan that people vote on, people can object to, but ultimately it's the best of a bad deal, the best that everybody can see making out of the mess, a new compact that we'll go forward on. They're trying to make a deal. They're not trying to litigate to the nth degree. The goal of Chapter 9 or Chapter 11 is to try and make a deal if possible. In order to make the deal, you have to resolve a variety of legal issues about which people have disputes, and the court will do that one step at a time. For example, in Vallejo, ruling on whether it was insolvent and entitled to file, ruling on the question of whether the rejection of the contracts was appropriate. But those are tools, those are means to try to work through the problems and get a deal. in that kind of context, the role of a judge in a Chapter 9 takes on this interesting hybrid of both being a mediator and an arbitrator. A mediator in the sense that the powers of the bankruptcy judge are more limited in Chapter 9, as we've discussed, and therefore trying to get people to agree on things is partly a process of trying to indicate the wisdom of a course of action, directly or indirectly, trying to ask the questions that push the people into realizing what their real situation is, try and structure the process of resolving the specific disputes in such a way as to give the parties an opportunity to reach agreement, but be willing to rule if they can't. But overall, it's a structured mediation-arbitration kind of arrangement where the goal is to try and get a deal, and ultimately, if there's no deal, the judge will have to rule. But in Chapter 9, the judge can only go so far in the ruling. So getting the right judge in Chapter 9 is really far more important in some respects than getting the right judge in Chapter 11, because the judge has to be a bit wily, has to be flexible, has to be insightful about what's going on in the political process to try to encourage, prod, or hit over the head with a 2x4 the various parties who need to get real about what's possible. And in that regard, finally, if the judge says, look, there's no way to do this other than raise taxes. We've done everything possible. We've gone through everything. So I'm finding that it's necessary to raise taxes in one form or another, you know, making that kind of a statement or ruling on the bench. That gives some political cover to the participants in the process to say, well, the judge made us do it. And judges are happy to take the role of the judge made us do it. That's part of the job. And so it's unusual in that sense, but you really need the right judge, and the right judge can make a huge difference in whether the parties see the light and cut the deals.
So we've been talking for a while, and I want to make sure that the press that's listening to the call have a chance to ask some questions. So why don't we open up to taking questions now?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question by pressing the pound key. Once again, press star and one to ask a question, and we'll pause a moment to wait for questions to queue up. At this time, there are no questions in the queue.
Okay, so you know, maybe we should take a minute to talk about the future of Chapter 9s. Do you think we're going to see a wave of Chapter 9 filings in the next couple of years or not? What does it look like if we gaze into the crystal ball?
This is Mark. Let me start with that one, because I'll go back to the bill that almost made it through the California legislature this year, made it through the Senate, or the Assembly, but not the Senate, and will be reintroduced next year. The lead-off to the bill, there's a long preamble, says that, you know, Chapter 9 is, there's going to be a landslide of Chapter 9s, and we need to stop this at the California state level because it's hurting California in the view, it's causing California financial harm and hurting the state in the eyes of the world, which I found kind of funny because California is insolvent to the tune of $8 to $20 billion, depending on who you talk to. But the unions are certainly selling this bill to legislators, and they were very successful in doing it at the Assembly level, that there's a wave of Chapter 9s coming. I think none of the three of us believe that that's going to happen because of the eligibility requirements that we've been discussing with you. Because it is so costly, so painful, so time-consuming, so distracting, and so hard on the residents that you avoid it at all possible costs. And that's exactly what's happened to date. We filed the Vallejo case at the end of May of 2008, so that was a year and a half ago or so. We haven't seen one municipality, maybe a hospital district here or there, but no cities or counties in California have filed, even though each one is hurting. What instead has happened is exactly the right thing, is that the parties, including unions throughout the states, have recognized the problem, have recognized that Chapter 9 is an alternative, and have fought to avoid it. That's what good parties do in Chapter 11. They're the best lawyers, and you've got two good ones plus me on the phone, who do Chapter 11 cases, is you try to keep your clients out of Chapter 11 rather than put them in. And you do so if you're dealing with sophisticated people on the other side by saying, this is what can happen in Chapter 11. Let's just do it ourselves outside of Chapter 11, and so far that's what's happened in Chapter 9, and hopefully that will continue. Hopefully there'll never be another Chapter 9 case in California, that parties will be able to work their differences out before, without the need for it. But although, as Lisa said, because of these legacy costs, sooner or later it's going to catch up, but perhaps maybe not during my lifetime.
There's another dimension to this. This is Bruce, and that is that in addition to a lot of the kind of advanced restructuring going on, which is a good thing, there's also a lot of shifting the problem around, which is only a good thing if the problem doesn't last that long. What do I mean by that? You know, in general, in California and in the nation in particular, we've had a lot of long bursts of prosperity followed by short bursts of recessions. And what municipalities did when they had fall-offs in tax revenues is they deferred expenses, they accelerated revenues, which means, you know, borrow from other periods. They made borrowings from all kinds of special purpose accounts, some of which perfectly clearly legal, no issues, some of which a little bit less clearly legal, but no one really dug into it too deeply because everyone regarded it as necessary. And then times got better, and municipalities were able to pay back money borrowed across period lines and pay back money borrowed across different fund lines. The real question for everyone is how long and deep, more long being the issue, will this recession and this decrease in tax revenues really last? Because as you saw with the state of California, the state of California closed some of its budget deficit by making cuts in services. It closed some more by raising taxes, although exceptionally modestly, because the population wouldn't tolerate more. And a lot of the relief that they got was by accelerating revenues from future years into the current years, deferring expenses, and borrowing from municipalities by taking away property tax revenues and other borrowing within state funds. You can only do that for so long. And if the difficult times last for a long time, you are going to find some municipalities that will have delved too deeply into the resources that were available across period lines and across fund lines and will be in a position where they really will have a liquidity crisis, which, as we said at the beginning, that's what trigger cases. I personally think we're a little bit away from that. Not this year, this budget year. I think next budget year we should start to be more concerned, and the year after that we should definitely be concerned.
Lisa,
I very much agree this is a longer-term problem, and if there's a downward turn in the economy within the next couple of years, which is one possible scenario, there could be a sharp downturn, it will expedite the filings. But I believe that in the long run, unless some of the underlying tax limitations are resolved in California, the end of the game has got to be every single municipality in the state of California just about is going to be bankrupt with the legacy costs. So the difficulty is mobilizing the political will to deal with the overhang of legacy costs when it's not a today problem. And unless there's an answer to that, we will be in bankruptcy court with the legacy issues in some form or another. That could be a 10 or 20 year. I think it's going to happen in our lifetime, Mark. I certainly hope to live long enough to see that because I believe it's within the 10 to 20 year horizon, and I intend to be around. But it is not going to go away. It's structurally built in to the system, particularly here in California, and I don't think California is unique in that respect other than the very serious restrictions on the taxation system.
Okay, are there any concluding thoughts from any of our panelists? Well, if not, then I'd like to thank everyone who participated in the call. Thank you very much. This has been, I think, very informative for me, and I hope for all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.